previously on Beta.
I think the atomic bomb was procured through channels which were not normal.
Dude, stick to what people like you for, taking your shirt off and growl singing at Ashanti.
Flight 209er clear for Vector 324.
We have clearance, Clarence.
Roger, roger. What's our vector, Victor?
Now our radio clearance, over. That's Clarence, over. Over. Roger.
Huh? Roger, over.
Hi, welcome aboard Beta Flight 123 from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm your captain, Doug Gordon. We're broadcasting comfortably at about 450,000 watts, and we should arrive at your next program, I'd say in about 53, 54 minutes, give or take a few seconds. For your meal today, you'll have your choice of chicken or fish. Flight attendants will be through the cabin shortly. Today's in-flight entertainment includes a talk with Wisconsinite Jim Abrams. He'll talk about his involvement with the comedy classic Airplane. Have you seen it? It's out. For those of you who missed your connection to the Bahamas for the Fire Festival in 2017, well, you're in luck. We're going to take a look back at it with documentary filmmaker Chris Smith. He'll tell us how not to put on a music festival.
They sold and marketed this luxury festival in the Bahamas on a remote island, and it was something that everyone bought into and believed in and wanted to experience. The reality was just something totally different.
And folks, if you look to your left, that's the port side there, you'll see a giant seaplane known as the H-4 Hercules attempting takeoff.
Ladies and gentlemen, the new Mammoth aircraft has flown this afternoon in Los Angeles Harbor.
That was a clip from movie mogul Howard Hughes' historic flight of his giant flying boat, Spruce Goose. Speaking of Howard Hughes, you might be familiar with the hit podcast, You Must Remember This. It explores the secret and forgotten histories of the early days of Hollywood. Karina Longworth is the creator and host of the show, and she's also the author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood.
Well, the period that Hughes was active in Hollywood is basically the mid-1920s through the end of the 1950s. And that's almost exactly what historians refer to as the classical Hollywood era. So that's when the studio system is at its peak. And during that time, you have the entire evolution of the first wave of Hollywood and of the studio system. You have the transition from silent film to sound. You have the establishment of a censorship board and then the collapse of that censorship board. You have the Hollywood blacklist, which comes about in the late 40s and early 1950s, where the studios, under pressure from government forces, make a big deal about expelling supposed communists from the industry. And Howard Hughes is involved in all of these things.
You say that in his films, Hughes commodified male desire more blatantly than any mainstream filmmaker of his time, and in turn helped produce an incredibly influential sexualized image of womanhood that has impacted American culture ever since. Can you give me an example of one of the ways he did this early on in his movie-making career?
Sure. It's not like he invented the idea of women being sexy in movies. I think that one of the reasons why cinema caught on as it did is this voyeuristic thing that both men and women can have in the audience of looking at beautiful people. That's an exciting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But up to the point where Howard Hughes is making his first directorial effort, Hell's Angels, which he's making in the late 1920s and was released in 1930, the sort of manipulation of the audience's desires was relatively classy, generally. I mean, there was some small glimpses of nudity in films, but generally it was artistically done. With this film, Hell's Angels, Howard Hughes built much of the film, but the entirety of the marketing campaign around the promise of looking at Jean Harlow's scantily clad body. So he designs this gown for her to wear in the film, and it's a film set during World War I and is supposedly about fighter pilots. But he designs this gown for her to wear that is completely threadbare. In black and white film, it appears to be the same color of her skin. It's totally backless. And he sets this climactic scene around her wearing it and dancing with one of the male characters. And he just shoots her with her bosoms heaving.
With Hell's Angels, Howard Hughes began the tradition of making stars of unknowns.
Would you be shocked if I put on something more comfortable?
after appearing in Hell's Angels, Gene Harlow became the platinum blonde sex symbol of the 1930s and a Hollywood superstar.
And then the entirety of the marketing campaign, again, for this movie that's ostensibly a war movie about fighter pilots, and for which the most people would say that the creative value of the movie is in these aviation scenes, the entire marketing campaign is based around the image of Jean Harlow's body. So you have these posters where there's a huge painting of her sort of like leaning back in a dress that is falling off of her and teeny tiny images of airplanes all around her.
Hmm.
So he's selling the body. He's selling the female body, even though that's not what the movie is even about.
Hell's Angels, directed by Howard Hughes, a motion picture for all time.
You mentioned this marketing campaign, which was totally focused on Jean Harlow and in particular her chest. Was there any controversy about the marketing campaign at the time it came out?
Certainly it was unusual. And I think the pushback came more from the industry itself than anyone else. And this would be a pattern that Hughes would see throughout his career. All of the other studios, all of the other producers and marketers had been playing by the same kinds of rules and had, you know, sort of been keeping the promotion of sexuality in line because there had been so much criticism in the 1920s of Hollywood as being this cesspool with all of these scandals. And then Hughes completely disregarded that and just did what he knew would sell. And so that frustrates the people who are restraining themselves from doing that kind of marketing.
Yes, the outlaw is coming.
In 1941, Howard Hughes started working on a Western movie called The Outlaw, which was Jane Russell's debut. Originally, there was a different director. Howard Hawks was directing it, but Hughes fired him and took over as director. Why did Howard Hughes fire Hawks?
Well, according to internal memos, it was because Hughes didn't like the footage that was coming back from the first couple of weeks of shooting. My theory of reading everything about the production of this film was that Hughes was impatient because Hawks had not shot with Jane Russell yet. She had been off doing publicity photo shoots while Hawks worked with the male actors. And I think Hughes really felt like the value of the movie that he knew how to promote was this beautiful young woman with heaving breasts. And he was impatient to see footage of her.
More excitement and thrills than has ever been in one picture before. And yet it is unlike anything you have ever seen. At last, the screen has dared to tell the story of the outlaw.
Didn't he do something to make Jane Russell's breasts even more prominent in the film?
It's become legend that he designed a bra for her to wear in the film, and he did design a bra, but according to Jane Russell, she tried it on and felt that it was uncomfortable and ridiculous. And so what she did was she took it off, put her old bra back on, and covered the seams of the bra with Kleenex, and then put her costume on, and Hughes couldn't tell the difference.
So by this time, there was a censorship board, right?
Well, there was a censorship board in the late 1920s that only became effective in 1934.
So how did the censorship board react to Hughes's focus on Jane Russell's breasts in The Outlaw?
I think Hughes successfully sold the idea that The Outlaw was a movie that the censors didn't want you to see that was too sexy. Uh-huh. But in fact, when he finished the film, he submitted it to the censorship board and they gave it their seal of approval. What they objected to was the marketing of the film. Hughes was doing things to market this film that had never been done before. He sent a blimp over Los Angeles shaped like a breast. He had a skywriters draw two circles with dots in the air. And under it, it said, "The outlaw is coming." There were newspaper ads in which there were cartoons of a man pinning down Jane Russell, which is essentially the rape scene that's in the film. And there were drawings of Jane Russell in newspaper ads where it looked like she was wearing no shirt. So it was this kind of thing that the censors pushed back on.
As you mentioned, there's a controversial rape scene in the film. And let me take a moment to offer a quick trigger warning to our listeners. Can you tell me about this scene?
Yeah, so The Outlaw tells the story of Billy the Kid, and near the beginning of the movie, he meets this young woman played by Jane Russell. Her character's name is Rio, and Rio knows that Billy the Kid killed her brother, and so she tries to attack him with a pitchfork, and Billy the Kid pins her down, gets rid of the pitchfork, and as punishment for her coming at him with the pitchfork, he rapes her. And you don't see this, the sexual violence, but you can hear it. You know that he's thrown her down behind this block of hay, and he's pinning her down, and you hear her struggle.
Let me go!
Hold still, lady, or you won't have much dress left.
Let me go!
So it's very clear what's happening. But then it seems confused, because for the rest of the movie, she's in love with him, and she's almost a hypnotic slave to him. It completely changes her personality in a way that is extremely unrealistic. And it makes it seem like what Hughes was trying to convey was that if you encounter a feisty, independent woman, you have to tame her.
I'm curious about how Hughes was able to get this rape scene past the censor. Is it because, as you said, you don't see the sexual violence, you just hear it? Is that why?
Well, certainly, because there's no visual, there's nothing to protest against. In memos between Hughes' screenwriter, Jules Furthman, and the members of the censorship board while the film was being made, they expressed concern about the scene in the script, and the screenwriter said, but don't worry, you won't see any sex, only violence. And then they were placated by that.
Interesting. Jane Russell didn't have an affair with Howard Hughes, right?
I don't believe that they did, no, and I haven't seen any credible evidence that they did. She writes in her memoir of one night deep into their relationship, years after they first met, where she ended up spending the night at his house because I think she was too drunk to drive home, mm-hmm. and he tried to get in bed with her, and she just told him no, and that was it.
Despite the fact that apparently they didn't have an affair, Hughes' treatment of Russell must have done a lot of emotional and psychic damage to her.
Certainly, years after The Outlaws, she became very vocal about this feeling that she had, that she had been exploited by the film and by the marketing of the film. You know, she was a devout Christian, and she enjoyed being beautiful and she enjoyed being sexy, but she didn't enjoy feeling like her body was being put on display for men to ogle at. And it really was many years after she started filming The Outlaw before she was able to really show her full range of talents in a film. I mean, I cite Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which she made in 1953, over a decade after finishing The Outlaw, as being the first film to really showcase everything that Jane Russell could do, from comedy to singing to dancing.
Hughes comes across as very manipulative and very unlikable in your book, but is there anything that you have any empathy for him?
Yeah, I mean, he died alone without anybody around who wasn't paid to be there. It's his fault.
Yeah, of course.
Because he had pushed away, he had refused any kind of emotional intimacy and pushed away anybody who he could have had that with. But I think that, you know, I have a lot of empathy for somebody who dies in that situation.
You started writing Seduction before the Me Too movement and the Harvey Weinstein story made headlines. How do you see your book fitting into this current cultural moment that we're in right now?
I finished it, actually, before the Weinstein revelations came out. So, or at least I finished the first draft. So I don't see it as a Me Too book at all. It's not influenced by that movement. This is history. You know, this is stuff that happened a long time ago. If anything, I see parallels not between Howard Hughes and Harvey Weinstein or any of those people, but between Howard Hughes and Donald Trump. I mean, I see them both as these master manipulators of the media who consistently tell lies and pretend that they're not, pretend that they're truth tellers, pretend that they're rebels, even though they're completely corporate manipulators. And their attitudes to women, you know, are somewhat similar in that it seems very difficult for both of them to see women as human beings.
Karina Longworth is the author of Seduction: Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood. She's also the host of the hit podcast You Must Remember This, which is all about vintage Hollywood. Sounds like a song from a classic film, doesn't it? That title, very Casablanca-esque. Learn more about Karina at wpr.org/beta.
You know, one of the employees says, thankfully no one got hurt, but this was fraud. And Ja sort of responds that, no, this wasn't fraud. It wasn't fraud. It was false advertising.
Wisconsin filmmaker Chris Smith talks about his documentary Fire, the greatest party that never happened. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Doug Gordon. If you weren't on social media in April of 2017, you might have missed out on one of the most epic fails of all time, when the Fyre Music Festival set in the Bahamas went up in flames. The festival promised popular music performances, luxury accommodations, the chance to mingle with influencers, and great food. But unfortunately, it did not go according to plan. Attendees who had paid thousands of dollars flooded platforms like Twitter and Instagram to share the disaster in real time. Chris Smith is the director of the Netflix documentary called Fyre, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. And Seth Crosnell signed up to attend the festival. They joined us to provide an inside story into the Fyre Fest fiasco and who was to blame for the mess. Chris shares why he felt the desire to make the film and how he went about putting it together.
You know, I started with just a handful of interviews just to do an exploration to see what might be there. I did an interview with Gabrielle Bluestone, who was one of the main journalists that were covering it at Vice. And through her was introduced to a number of other people and other entities. The main interview that sort of pulled me in was an interview with Mark Weinstein, mm-hmm. who was one of the event contractors. And, you know, we sat down with him thinking it would be, you know, 45 minutes or an hour. And it ended up being a 3.5-hour interview where he sort of just went through the entire experience in such detail. And his ability to look back and reflect on that time and that experience, you know, really sort of, to me, gave the project a soul.
In his review of Fyre for The Guardian, Adrian Horton writes that, quote, one of the more dizzying aspects of internet life is the surreal experience of digital agency, present but not in person. You help narratize an event in real time through engagement, end quote. And it seems to me that Horton's comment really gets at one of the major themes of your documentary, this idea of the internet often being a fantasy world versus the cold, hard reality of real life. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this was a real-world example of that idea. It was, you know, they sold and marketed this luxury festival in the Bahamas on a remote island, and it was something that everyone, you know, bought into and believed in and wanted to experience. And so, you know, what the reality was just something totally different.
Yeah, so one of the key players behind this, even the key player, is Billy McFarland, and he's this guy who's the founder of the Fyre Media and also the festival. Can you tell me a bit about him?
Yeah, Billy was, you know, from all accounts, an entrepreneur from a young age. As he got older, you know, he started a company called Spling, I believe, which was sold, and then he went on to Magnesis.
This is Magnesis. It's the newest, coolest credit card.
The original vision was simple. I mean, we were just kids. We had figured out a way to turn boring plastic cards into nice-looking, sleek, stainless steel credit cards.
It was black. The thing was metal. It would make a big clank when you put it down. The girls were like, holy hell, like, what is that? Like, what do you do?
Billy really is one of the world's greatest salesmen. He could convince anyone of pretty much anything.
This is a young kid who figured out how to get these millennials and lock them in.
They offered like deals and discounts, and the big thing that they had was this clubhouse in West Village.
And while they were doing events, he wanted to book Ja Rule to come perform. And the process was, you know, very difficult, and he had to go through a number of different people. And so by the time they actually did connect, they started talking and they realized that there was an opportunity there to start a talent booking platform. And that's really where Fyre was born.
And at one point in your film, Billy McFarland says that we're selling a pipe dream to your average loser, your average guy in middle America. But this is something that your average guy in America couldn't afford, right? It was very expensive.
It's hard to say. I mean, there was some misconception that, you know, the tickets, you know, people were spending $50,000 or $250,000 for a yacht package or whatever. But I think, Seth, you found that the tickets were actually much less, right?
Yeah, right when we learned about the festival, it was this pre-sale option, get in now. It's $1,000 for, you know, the option we chose, which was, you know, 4 king beds. So it was $1,000 a person, basically. And, you know, buy this now because it's going to jump up to $12,000 or something like that. And so you see in the film that these boat and yacht packages kind of were added later on. to try to generate some cash.
And when you look at what they were offering for that amount of money, it was actually, you know, seemed like a really good deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a music festival that, you know, was in the Bahamas for 4 or 5 days for $1,000 seemed like a really great deal.
Early on, the marketing for the festival was very well done. How did the fire team promote the fire festival?
You know, when they went about starting the promotion, they actually went down to the Bahamas 3 times, and they went with different groups of talent.
Billy then had no rules. He had everyone drinking, open bar, wilding out. It was like more of a party than a promotional shoot.
Yeah, let me fly the drone.
Fire guys were partying nonstop, sun up to sundown, getting loose. Billy fell asleep on the beach, literally just broad daylight, out like a light.
The third trip, you know, they had some of the, you know, top models, you know, Instagram models and, you know, runway models, and that they had brought down and were able to sort of create this facade. And it was incredibly well done for the target audience that they were going after.
Kendall Jenner was paid, I think, $250,000 by wire transfer just to post that one post.
When I saw the video, my first reaction was confusion. I wasn't sure who was the target market for the Fire Festival. Like, if you go to the festival, will there be Instagram models lounging around to Fiji grapes? So it was a combination of, like, confusion and excitement.
As soon as the models started posting, the Fire Instagram account just started to blow up. Overnight, basically, this massive, massive influx of enthusiasm and awareness, a PR storm like you've never seen.
So now, you know, we hope everybody comes and enjoys the cultural experience of the decade, Fire Festival.
It was really the execution that was dodgy, wasn't it? The festival was originally going to be held on an island owned by Pablo Escobar, and then they had to find another island with only about 6 to 8 weeks left before the festival. Is that right?
It seemed that way, and I think that the original intent was to do the festival on that island. You know, when that fell apart, they looked at a different island and then another island, and they ended up on Great Exuma.
Yeah, and then as they're having all of these difficulties building the infrastructure and there aren't enough houses and they've got all these geodesic dome tents, people who bought tickets still hadn't heard about their accommodation. This is just days before the event. And so let me ask both of you, what happened when people arrived?
My arrival was kind of similar to a lot of the others that you see and in the film.
Oh, yeah, like they didn't start construction on any of this until maybe a month ago. We see this sea of white little tents.
You first drive up to the site and you see shipping containers and Amazon boxes and mattresses and these tents everywhere. And
there was a disbelief on the bus. A lot of people thought that, oh, you know, maybe we're passing through this area. You know, our villas are just on the other side.
And it was the bus driver who said, oh no, that's where you're staying. It was like, oh my God.
Look at the beds.
Oh,
look at the beds.
Jesus. This festival is never happening again. I hope they know that.
There's just no organization at all. And finally, Billy stood up on a table and told everybody, you know, we just go grab a tent. And then that kind of created a free-for-all that was pretty chaotic. And then if you had luggage, you had to go try to find that. By that time, it was getting pretty dark outside, and DJ music was blaring the entire time.
Billy came up to me and told me to just blast the music as out as I possibly could.
Everyone was like making noise, like, where I'm gonna stay, what I'm gonna do, what I'm gonna eat.
The attendees were looking towards anything, anyone, for direction.
Yeah, so it was a really nightmarish experience for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Chris, one of the most heartbreaking aspects of this whole story has to do with the many Bahamians who worked long hours to help McFarland meet his deadline. Many of them never got paid for their hard work. You have the scene featuring Marianne Roll, a Bahamian restaurateur. What happened to her?
Yeah, so Marianne got involved with these guys and started providing meals for the staff, for the people that were building the site. And so she started, you know, enlisting more people to help, and the whole operation just started to grow as, you know, they were working incredibly long hours to try to get the festival site ready because time was running out.
I had to literally pay all those people. I am here as a Bahamian. I went through about $50,000 of my savings that I could have had for rainy day. Personally, I don't even like to talk about the Fire Festival. Just take it away and just let me start a new beginning. Because they really, really, really hurt me.
And so, you know, in this chaos, certain bills weren't getting paid. You know, so she took it upon herself to keep the operation going. And so she invested her own time and her own money with the understanding that, you know, that she would be paid back. And I don't think it was an unrealistic expectation based on, you know, the perception of fire in the Bahamas. You know, there was a lot of celebrity, a lot of noise. So I think that everyone just felt like it was so chaotic because there was so much to do and that everything would work out once the festival had gone off.
Yeah. There's a very compelling scene after the whole disaster. There's a compelling scene in which the fire employees are having this crisis meeting with Ja Rule. I think Ja Rule's on the phone. He's not there in person. And Billy McFarland is there. What happened at this meeting?
Well, they're talking about the fallout, and they're talking about, you know, Billy apologizes for how the festival went down, and they're sort of having a team meeting to figure out, you know, the state of the company going forward. And in that, you know, one of the employees says,
I mean, that's fraud. Like, no, and that's not okay, like, no, as a company operates.
No, that's not fraud. That's not fraud. That is, I would call that false advertising.
Yeah, what is the difference?
You know, but in his defense, it's like, you know, they were in a really bad spot. And he was,
oh, yeah.
He was exercising, showing some leadership there. And I think, yes, you can say what you will about sort of the plan, but it was, you know, he was trying to find a way forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you try to interview Ja Rule and Billy McFarland for your film?
We did try to interview Billy. We were set up to film Billy once or twice. And in the end, Billy came back to us and said he wanted to get paid. He said he was being offered $250,000 from another production. And we just said we couldn't do that. And then he said, how about $125,000? And then we said we couldn't do that. And then he came back and said, how about $100,000 in cash?
Wow.
And we're just, at that point, you know, it just didn't make sense.
Yeah. There's this new Hulu documentary about the Fire Festival called Fire Fraud. Have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't.
Do you plan to see it?
You know, I've lived it for the last year. I don't think I need to see it again.
Yeah, there's been some controversy about the Hulu doc because it contains an exclusive interview with Billy McFarland, and apparently he was paid for it. And Hulu is challenging the ethics of your film because it was produced in partnership with Jerry Media, the social media agency that helped promote the Fire Festival in the first place. Is that true?
Yeah, we worked with a lot of different people that were affected or worked for Fire. It was a way to get the inside story, which to me was what actually made this interesting.
Yeah.
Was to be on, you know, have a front row seat to actually what happened. So, you know, we worked with different contractors that had worked for Fire, and we worked with different agencies that had worked with Fire that had footage, which to me was instrumental in telling the story because you got to actually see this world and experience this world firsthand as opposed to just having talking heads sort of walk you through what happened.
Yeah. So what is your response to Hulu's accusations of this being an ethical problem?
You know, I think it's unfounded. Jerry Media lost over $100,000. Matt Projects lost over $200,000. Almost all the contractors that we talked to didn't get paid. You know, so there were a number of people that were adversely affected by their experience with Fire, and this film was sort of telling that story.
Yeah. What is Billy McFarland doing now?
Billy's in prison.
For how long?
6 years.
What was he found guilty of?
He was defrauding investors for Fire Media and then also defrauded people related to Fire Festival. And while he was waiting to be sentenced for those charges, he started another company called NYC VIP Access, which targeted Fire Festival attendees and emailed them offers like Masters tickets and Victoria's Secret Fashion Show tickets and Met Gala tickets. And I think he convinced a number of people to give him over $100,000 for these tickets that didn't exist. So he got charged with that as well. Ultimately, he's going to be in prison for 6 years and I think a 3-year supervised release or something.
Yeah. M. David Lowe, the former creative director of Fire Media, describes Billy McFarland as an operational sociopath. Would you agree with that?
He just doesn't take no for an answer. And I think if that fits the definition, that might be accurate.
Chris, what do you want people to take away from watching your film?
I mean, ultimately, You know, this definitely touches on influencers, influencer marketing, you know, this idea of perception versus reality.
Yeah.
And sort of the way we represent ourselves online.
Chris Smith is the director of the Netflix documentary Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. And Seth Krosno is one of the subjects featured in the film. You can find out more about Chris, Seth, and the whole story at WPR.org/beta.
There are movies like Dr. Strangelove, which is satire, which has a political point of view. I don't think we ever had a political point of view. Our point of view was, hey, look, you don't have to take this seriously.
Filmmaker Jim Abrams on why we're still talking about Airplane nearly 40 years after it redefined comedy movies. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. What's going on, Steve? Is everything okay? Oh, I guess I'll have to deploy my emergency auto engineer, Otto. That's better. Hi, this is Doug Gordon, and welcome back to Beta. It looks like I'm going to have to land this show by myself because our executive producer, Adam Friedrich, and our engineer, Steve Gotcher, must have had the fish. I told them to have the chicken, but they wouldn't listen to me. Hey, this sounds like a plot I've heard before. Surely you know which film I'm talking about. That's right, it's that 1980 classic Airplane. Did you know that Airplane was the brainchild of three Wisconsinites from the Milwaukee area? Jim Abrams and the Zucker Brothers, David and Jerry.
We knew each other as kids. Mm-hmm. Our dads were business partners, but I'm 3 years older than David and 6 years older than Jerry, so we really didn't know, hang out together when we were growing up. After college, I needed to find a job. Well, I didn't have a car, so I wound up looking in the newspaper and found that if you're an insurance adjuster, that job comes with a car. So I took a job as an insurance adjuster with American Family Insurance. But one day I was out and about being an insurance adjuster, and I ran into David Zucker. And he said to me, we've got access to something called videotape equipment. Oh. You want to come over and we'll mess around with it. So we got together in their basement in Shorewood, Wisconsin, and we just started recording spoofs of current commercials or movies of the time. And when we got together, it was a very politically charged time. You know, there is Vietnam and Nixon and Black Power and feminism, and all the stuff was going on. But our instinct was always to make fun of the silly stuff in media. So we never went to all the kind of obvious sources for comedy. We just said, isn't that a stupid commercial?
Yeah, this was a really politically charged time. You and the Zucker mm-hmm. brothers were attending UW-Madison, and then you decided to form this sketch comedy troupe called Kentucky Fried Theater. So when you did that, were you still looking at making fun of the media rather than, you know, satirizing what was going on politically?
Yeah, that was our instinct. I don't think we ever... Obviously, there were Ace Trucking Company. There were a bunch of mm-hmm. groups in that era who were making political jokes and stuff, and there were lots of easy, obvious targets. But that was just never our instinct. Our instinct was always to watch a movie and say, isn't that silly?
Then also, because of the fact that so many, as you mentioned, so many other people were taking advantage of politics and using that as kind of their muse and inspiration, Kentucky Fried Theater would have stood out because, hey, these are the guys who, you know, make fun of the media and things.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what happened. We opened the theater first at the University of Wisconsin and ran it there for a year, and then decided we'd try to expand our careers a little and move to California, see if we can make it onto The Tonight Show. So we packed up all of our chairs and our gear and stuff in a U-Haul from Madison and drove to Los Angeles and found an old warehouse and kind of rehabbed it and turned it into Kentucky Fried Theater in Los Angeles, and that did extremely well.
Then in 1977, you and the Zucker brothers took Kentucky Fried Theater and turned it into a film. You wrote a screenplay for Kentucky Fried Movie, which was directed by John Landis, who, of course, is famous for many movies, including Animal House, American Werewolf in London. And I remember seeing Kentucky Fried Movie and being really knocked out by it.
I remember making Kentucky Fried Movie, and I remember thinking, someday I'm going to get married. Someday I'm going to have kids, and someday I'm going to have to explain this to them.
And how'd that go over?
Not so well, although I must say, when my oldest kid was like 8 or 9, I walked into the TV room in our house, and he was sitting around with 3 or 4 of his buddies, and the frame was frozen on a shot from a skit from Kentucky Fried Movie called Catholic High School Girls in Trouble. And if you remember that skit, you can probably guess what frame that they had frozen.
More shocking than Behind the Green Door, Catholic High School Girls in Trouble.
That's basically what the film, the Kentucky Right. Fried Movie contained largely unconnected sketches that, for the most part, parodied various film genres, right?
Exactly. And some of Kentucky Fried Movie, actually what happened was we invited John Landis to see Kentucky Fried Theater. And he was the one who suggested, he said, well, why don't you make this into a movie? And we said, how do you do that? And he said, well, first you have to write a script. And he said, how do you do that? So he gave us a script to copy its form. And it turns out that script was American Werewolf in London.
Oh, yeah. And then you also, in addition to these film trailers, these mock trailers, you also spoofed TV commercials and right. news broadcasts and classroom right. educational films.
In the past year, over 800,000 Americans have died. Despite millions of dollars of research, death continues to be our nation's number one killer. Hello, I'm Henry Gibson, speaking to you on behalf of the United Appeal for the Dead.
And so it was well received, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very well received, and it was very kind of, for certainly considering the budget, it was very well received. I think it cost $600,000 or something like that to make. And so suddenly we were three guys who wrote a movie that did pretty well.
Then now, surely now, is the perfect time to talk about the big movie you
made. Did you say surely on purpose?
Yeah, I did.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
But anyway, now's the perfect time to talk about the 1980 movie that you, David, and Jerry Zucker wrote and directed together, and that is still so famous that we're talking about it, Airplane. Where did the idea for Airplane come from?
The way we would get material for Kentucky Fried Theater, a lot of it, what we would do when we were running the theater is we'd leave the tape recorder on all night long, because that's when the stupidest, you know, commercials and shows tend to come on.
Yes.
So one day, and I'm thinking it was 1973, we got to work in the morning and we looked at what we had videotaped the night before, and there was this movie called Zero Hour. Mm. And it was the story of a pilot, not clear what war, who had PTSD and was in love with this girl, and she was a stewardess, and he followed her onto the plane, and then there was food poisoning on the plane, and he had to overcome his demons and land the plane, which is Airplane.
Yeah.
But a very straightforward melodrama of Airplane. So we thought, wow, this is perfect.
All yeah.
we had, and because the story was great and the characters were great, and all we had to do was sort of like hang our jokes on the story, and we could make a movie.
Yeah, and didn't you guys think that your script borrowed so much from Zero Hour, the 1957 film, that you thought you had to buy the rights?
We did have to. I think it was for $2,500. We bought the rights to Zero Hour. There are very specific rules about parody and what you can do and what you can't do. But certainly we crossed the line. We took their character and stories and a lot of lines. I mean, there's actually a line in Zero Hour that says,
the life of everybody aboard depends on just one thing. Finding someone back there who not only can fly this plane, but who didn't have fish for dinner.
The life of everyone on board depends upon just one thing. Finding someone back there who can not only fly this plane, but who didn't have fish for dinner.
Airplane's chock full of surreal humor, slapstick comedy, visual and verbal puns, and it has a very fast pace. You kind of have to watch it repeatedly to catch everything. I'm curious about how the writing process worked. Were you and the Zuckers just riffing gags and bouncing ideas off one another?
Yeah, so the way that Dave and Jerry and I would work together is we would get together in the morning, like a regular office job pretty much, and drink coffee and procrastinate as long as we could and talk sports and politics and everything. And then we would start to look at the movies that we, and in the case of Airplane, we would look at it and say, wouldn't it be funny if in this scene...
You'd better tell the captain we've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now.
Excuse me, sir. There's been a little problem in the cockpit.
The cockpit? What is it?
It's the little room in the front of the plane where the pilots sit. That's not important right now.
To me, the most fun of the whole process was sitting in the room with those guys, coming up with jokes and then saying, yeah, but what if this? The rest of the time, you're kind of going through this process of trying to make it look on the screen the way you imagined it in your head.
Did you come close to making it look the way you imagined it in your head on the screen?
I think we did, yeah. And the key was, and obviously the biggest struggle was, to cast straight actors as opposed to comedians in the movie. And at first, Paramount was sort of resistant to that idea. Mm-hmm. They didn't quite understand why we wanted to do something like that. But to have Robert Stack and Lloyd Bridges and Leslie and Peter Graves, you know, who had had full careers of being dramatic actors, suddenly kind of spoof themselves was kind of the key, I think, to a lot of the success of Airplane. We wanted to duplicate what a real dramatic movie looks like and just add the jokes. And I think that there was something very endearing about those four actors spoofing themselves in a movie. And in essence, they had had full careers and they were kind of having a laugh at their own expense of their own careers.
Were any of them reluctant? Like, did they feel that, oh, I don't want to do this. This could ruin my career. I'm known as a dramatic actor.
I think they all were.
Yeah.
I think none more than Peter Graves, who winds up being a pedophile.
Joey, we have something here for our special visitors. Would you like to have it?
Thanks a lot.
Sure. You ever been in a cockpit before?
No, sir. I've never been up in a plane before.
Have you ever seen a grown man naked? Joey, do you ever hang around the gymnasium?
We better get back now, Joey.
No, Joey can stay here for a while if he'd like.
Could I?
At the time, was there any discussion? Like, was there debate about, geez, can we do this?
I'm telling you, in 39 years, is that what you said? 38, 39 years, no one's ever objected. Hmm. And no one ever says, you know, that's just out of bounds. And there are lots of jokes where they don't do that. There's this little girl who says she takes her coffee black like her men. That would never go over today. The nice thing is we got away with it and it's done and you can't undo it.
There are so many funny, so many iconic lines in Airplane that people still quote 38 years later. Surely you must have some personal favorites. Can you name a few?
Did you do that again?
Yeah, I did do it again, yeah. I can't put anything by you, Jim.
Yeah. Well, actually, over the years, I've had a bunch of personal favorites. But in the last several years, I think my favorite has become... There's a scene with Leslie, the doctor, Leslie Nielsen, mm-hmm. and Peter Graves, the pilot, and the doctor says...
Captain, how soon can you land?
I can't tell.
You can tell me I'm a doctor.
No, I mean, I'm just not sure.
Or can't you take a guess?
Well, not for another 2 hours.
You can't take a guess for another 2 hours?
And as opposed to virtually everything else in Airplane, that's not really a parody line. That's a satiric line. That's about medical arrogance. And as my life has panned out, my family's health has been affected by medical arrogance. Mm. And so for some reason, that line resonates the most with me. Obviously, at the time we wrote it, you know, it was just another joke.
Yeah, that brings up the point that you talked about both parody and satire. What is the difference in terms of Airplane? What do you consider parody and what do you consider satire?
I considered 99% of Airplane parody, making fun of the movie, making fun of the genre. Dave and Jerry and I have this conversation all the time. There are movies like Dr. Strangelove, which is satire, which has a political point of view. I don't think we ever had a political point of view. Our point of view was, hey, look, you don't have to take this seriously.
Is it true that casting Kareem Abdul-Jabbar as a pilot was a nod to a similar role that was played by UW football star Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch in Zero Hour?
Absolutely. Here, so in Zero Hour, the pilot is Elroy Hirsch. And as wonderful a football player and athletic director he was, he really couldn't act. And it was pretty obvious. So that was the key to it. Well, why don't we put someone in, you know, really well-known sports figure? Let's put a sports figure in the movie and call him out right in the middle of the movie.
Wait a minute. I know you. You're Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You play basketball for the Los Angeles Lakers.
I'm sorry, son, but you must have me confused with someone else. My name is Roger Murdoch. I'm the co-pilot.
I think you're the greatest, but my dad says you don't work hard enough on defense. And he says that lots of times you don't even run down court, and that you don't really try, except during the playoffs.
The hell I don't. Listen, kid, I've been hearing that crap ever since I was at UCLA. I'm out there busting my buns every night. Tell your old man to drag Walton and Lanier up and down the court for 48 minutes.
Joey, you like movies about gladiators?
Interestingly, all right. I'm not sure if it's interesting or not. I'll say it, and you can decide if it's interesting. We wrote the part originally for Pete Rose.
Oh.
But Airplane got greenlit in the summer, so we filmed during the summer, and Kareem was available, and Pete Rose was playing baseball. So that's how Kareem wound up in the movie.
How did you come up with the idea of casting America's favorite TV mom, Barbara Billingsley, and having her speak jive?
She actually was not our first choice. Our first choice was Harriet Nelson.
Oh, and Harriet, yeah.
And yeah, she would have been good too, huh?
She would have, but she didn't want to do it?
Legend is, I'm not sure if this is true, that Ricky kind of talked her out of it.
Oh, Ricky, jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. But Barbara Billingsley was great.
She was.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great scene.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Cuddy say can't hang.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
Oh, good.
He said that he's in great pain and he wants to know if you can help him.
All right, would you tell him to just relax and I'll be back as soon as I can with some medicine.
Just hang loose, blood. She's gonna catch up on the rebound on the med side.
What it is, big mama. My mama raised no dummies. I duck her rap.
Cut me some slack, Jack.
Oh, say,
chump don't want to help. Chump don't get the help.
How do you think that scene holds up today, looking through it through our current cultural lens?
People still laugh. That's my only measure. I've never heard objections to it. And I remember in 1980 going to a theater in Los Angeles that was an African-American community theater and watching those scenes just for that reason. And they laughed, you know, they laughed more, certainly as much as any other audience laughed, because when you look at those scenes, those are making fun of white people much more than they are, you know, it's spread around, but mostly, you know, it's making fun of white people.
What would a movie like Airplane fly today? I think I know what you say, but I've got to ask it.
Well, I hope so. I don't think we'd get away with it. You know, I just simply don't think we'd get away with it. I don't think we'd get away with those lines. I've seen it probably in the last couple years with an audience, which is really fun. It holds up as well today as it did back then. I would say lots of it holds up as well today as it did in 1980.
I won't deceive you, Mr. Stryker. We're running out of time.
Surely there must be something you can do.
I'm doing everything I can. And stop calling me Shirley.
That's Jim Abrams. He, along with David Zucker and Jerry Zucker, are the writers and directors of Airplane. You can find out more about Jim and Airplane at wpr.org/beta. Thank you.
get your captain again, or being any guard sent to the end of the show. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes during your next flight, subscribe to the Beta Podcast. You can do that via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And remember, you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Special thanks to guest producers Carl Christensen and Brad Kohlberg.
You guys look like... What do they look like, Jimmy?
Dorks. They look like a couple of dorks.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gatcher.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking.
Executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit drinking.
And very special thanks to Otto, our emergency auto engineer. And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I am your captain, Doug Gordon, signing off.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit amphetamines.
Thank you for choosing Beta today, and we hope you consider Beta for all your future audio needs. Enjoy the rest of your stay here in Radioland.